individuals can alter their genes during a single generation, according to the latest scientific thinking. While the process of genetic evolution can take thousands of years, a gene can successfully alter its expression through a behavior change or a novel experience within minutes, and then it may be passed on to the next generation. It helps to think of our genes less like stone tablets onto which our fate has been ceremoniously carved, and more like storehouses of an enormous amount of coded information, or even massive libraries of possibilities for the expression of proteins. But we can't just call the stored information up to make use of it the way a company might order something from its warehouse. It's as if we don't know what's in storage or how to access it, so we end up using just a small portion of what's truly available. In fact, we actually express only about 1.5% of our DNA, while the other 98.5% lies dormant in the body. Scientists call it junk DNA, but it's not really junk. They just don't know how all of that material is used yet, although they do know that at least some of it is responsible for making regulatory proteins. In reality, genes contribute to our characteristics, but do not determine them, writes Dawson Church, PhD, in his book, The Genie in Your Genes. The tools of our consciousness, including our beliefs, prayers, thoughts, intentions, and faith, often correlate much more strongly with our health, longevity, and happiness than our genes do. The fact is, just as there's more to our bodies than a sack of bones and flesh, there's more to our genes than just stored information. Now let's take a closer look at how genes are switched on. Several different factors can be responsible, actually, but for the sake of our discussion here about the mind-body connection, we'll keep it simple. Once a chemical messenger, for example a neuropeptide, from outside of the cell, from the environment, locks into the cell's docking station and passes through the cell membrane, it travels to the nucleus where it encounters the DNA. The chemical messenger modifies or creates a new protein, and then the signal it was carrying is translated to information now inside the cell. Then it enters the nucleus of the cell through a small window, and depending on the content of the protein message, it looks for a specific chromosome, a single piece of coiled DNA that contains many genes, within the nucleus, just as you might look for a specific book on the shelf in the library. Each of these strands is covered in a protein sleeve that acts as a filter between the information contained in the DNA strand and the rest of the intracellular environment of the nucleus. In order for the DNA code to be selected, the sleeve must be removed or unwrapped so that the DNA can be exposed, just as a book chosen from a library shelf then has to be opened before anyone can read it. The genetic code of DNA contains information waiting to be read and activated to create a particular protein. Until that information is exposed in the gene by unwrapping that protein sleeve, the DNA is latent. It's a potential storehouse of encoded information, just waiting to be unlocked or opened. You could think of the DNA as a parts list of potentials that are awaiting instructions to construct proteins, which regulate and maintain every aspect of life. Once the protein selects the chromosome, it opens it up by removing the outer covering around the DNA. Another protein then regulates and readies an entire gene sequence within the chromosome. Think of it as a chapter within a book, to be read all the way from the start of the sequence to its end. Once the gene is exposed and the protein sleeve is removed and read, another nucleic acid, called ribonucleic acid, RNA, is produced from the regulatory protein reading the gene. Now the gene is expressed or activated. The RNA exits the nucleus of the cell to be assembled into a new protein from the code the RNA carries. It has gone from being a blueprint of latent potential to being an active expression. The protein the gene creates can now construct, assemble, interact with, restore, maintain, and influence many different aspects of life, both within the cell and outside of it. Figure 4.2, A, B, C, and D, gives an overview of the process. Just as an architect gets all the information that's necessary to build a structure from a blueprint, the body gets all the instructions it needs to create complex molecules that keep us alive and operating from the chromosomes of our DNA. But before the architect reads the blueprint, it has to be pulled out of its cardboard tube and unrolled. Until then, it's just latent information waiting to be read. The cell is the same way. The gene is inert until its protein sheathing is removed, and the cell chooses to read the gene sequence. Scientists used to believe all the body needed was the information itself, the blueprint, to start construction. So that's what most of them focused on. They paid little attention to the fact that the whole cascade of events starts with the signal outside of the cell, which is, in fact, responsible for what genes within its library the cell chooses to read. That signal, as we now know, includes thoughts, choices, behaviors, experiences, and feelings. So it makes sense that if you can change these elements, you can also determine your genetic expression. If our genes don't seal our fate, and if they actually contain an enormous library of possibilities just waiting to be taken off the shelf and read, then what gives us access to those potentials? Potentials that could have a huge effect on our health and well-being. The men in the monastery study surely gained such access, but how did they do it? The answer lies in a relatively new field of study called epigenetics. The word epigenetics literally means above the gene. It refers to the control of genes not from within the DNA itself, but from messages coming from outside the cell. In other words, from the environment. These signals cause a methyl group, one carbon atom attached to three hydrogen atoms, to attach to a specific spot on a gene. And this process, called DNA methylation, is one of the main processes that turns the gene off or on. Two other processes, covalent histone modification and non-coding RNA, also turn genes on and off, but the details of those processes are more than we need for this discussion. Epigenetics teaches that we, indeed, are not doomed by our genes, and that a change in human consciousness can produce physical changes, both in structure and function in the human body. We can modify our genetic destiny by turning on the genes we want and turning off the ones we don't want through working with the various factors in the environment that program our genes. Some of those signals come from within the body, such as feelings and thoughts, while others come from the body's response to the external environment, such as pollution or sunlight. Epigenetics studies all of these external signals that tell the cell what to do and when to do it, looking at both the sources that activate or turn on gene expression, upregulating, and those that suppress or turn off gene expression, downregulating, as well as the dynamics of energy that adjust the process of cellular function on a moment-to-moment basis. Epigenetics suggests that even though our DNA code never changes, thousands of combinations, sequences and pattern variations in a single gene are possible, just as thousands of combinations, sequences and patterns of neural networks are possible in the brain. Looking at the entire human genome, so many millions of possible epigenetic variations exist that scientists find their heads spinning just thinking about it. The Human Epigenome Project, begun in 2003, as the Human Genome Project grew to a close, is underway in Europe, and some researchers have said that when it's completed, it will make the Human Genome Project look like homework that 15th century kids did with an abacus. Going back to the blueprint model, we can change the color of what we build, the type of materials we use, the scale of the construction, and even the positioning of the structure, making an almost infinite number of variations, all without ever changing the actual blueprint. A great example of epigenetics at work involves identical twins who share exactly the same DNA. If we embrace the idea of genetic predeterminism, the idea that all diseases are genetic, then identical twins should have exactly the same gene expression. However, they don't always manifest the same illnesses in the same way. And sometimes one will manifest a genetic disease that the other doesn't manifest at all. Twins can have the same genes, but different outcomes. A Spanish study illustrates this perfectly. Researchers at the Cancer Epigenetics Laboratory at the Spanish National Cancer Center in Madrid studied 40 pairs of identical twins, ranging in age from 3 to 74. They found that younger twins who had similar lifestyles and spent more years together had similar epigenetic patterns, while older twins, in particular those with dissimilar lifestyles, who spent fewer years together, had very different epigenetic patterns. For example, researchers found 4 times as many differentially expressed genes between one pair of 50-year-old twins as they did between a pair of 3-year-old twins. The twins were born with exactly the same DNA, but those with different lifestyles and different lives ended up expressing their genes very differently, especially as time went on. To use another analogy, the older twin pairs were like exact copies of the same model of a computer. The computers came loaded with some similar starter software, but as time went on, each downloaded very different additional software programs. The computer, the DNA, stays the same, but depending on what software a person has downloaded, the epigenetic variations, what the computer does and the way it operates can be quite different. So when we think our thoughts and feel our feelings, our bodies respond in a complex formula of biological shifts and alterations, and each experience pushes the buttons of real genetic changes within our cells. The speed of these changes can be truly remarkable. In just 3 months, a group of 31 men with low-risk prostate cancer were able to upregulate 48 genes, mostly dealing with tumor suppression, and downregulate 453 genes, mostly dealing with tumor promotion, by following an intensive nutrition and lifestyle regimen. The men enrolled in a study by Dean Ornish, MD, at the University of California at San Francisco, lost weight and reduced their abdominal obesity, blood pressure, and lipid profile over the course of the study. Ornish noted, "It is not really so much about risk factor reduction or preventing something bad from happening. These changes can occur so quickly you don't have to wait years to see the benefits." Even more impressive are the number of epigenetic changes made over a 6-month period in a Swedish study of 23 slightly overweight, healthy men who went from being relatively sedentary to attending spinning and aerobics classes, an average of just under 2x per week. Researchers at Lund University discovered that the men had epigenetically altered 7,000 genes, almost 30% of all the genes in the entire human genome. These epigenetic variations may even be inherited by our children and then passed on to our grandchildren. The first researcher to show this was Michael Skinner, PhD, who was director of the Center for Reproductive Biology at Washington State University. In 2005, Skinner led a study that exposed pregnant rats to pesticides. The male pups of the exposed mother rats had higher rates of infertility and decreased sperm production, with epigenetic changes in 2 genes. These changes were also present in about 90% of the males in each of the 4 generations that followed, even though none of these other rats were exposed to any pesticides. Our experiences from our external environment are only part of the story, however. As we've been learning, how we assign meaning to those experiences includes a barrage of physical, mental, emotional, and chemical responses that also activate genes. How we perceive and interpret the data we receive from our senses as factual information, whether that information is actually true or not, and the meaning we give it produce significant biological changes on a genetic level. Thus, our genes interact with our conscious awareness in complex relationships. We could say that meaning is continually affecting the neural structures that influence who we are on the microscopic level, which then influences who we are on the macroscopic level. The study of epigenetics also raises the question, what if nothing is changing in your external environment? What if you do the same things with the same people at exactly the same time every day? Things leading to the same experiences that produce the same emotions, that signal the same genes in the same way. We could say that as long as you perceive your life through the lens of the past and react to the conditions with the same neural architecture and from the same level of mind, you're headed toward a very specific, predetermined genetic destiny. In addition, what you believe about yourself, your life, and the choices you make as a result of those beliefs also keeps sending the same messages to the same genes. Only when the cell is ignited in a new way by new information can it create thousands of variations of the same gene to rewrite a new expression of proteins, which changes your body. You may not be able to control all the elements in your outer world, but you can manage many aspects of your inner world. Your beliefs, your perceptions, and how you interact with your external environment have an influence on your internal environment, which is still the external environment of the cell. This means that you, not your pre-programmed biology, hold the keys to your genetic destiny. It's just a matter of finding the right key that fits into the right lock to unleash your potential. So why not see your genes for what they really are? Providers of possibility, resources of unlimited potential, a code system of personal commands. In truth, they're nothing short of tools for transformation, which literally means changing form. Stress is one of the biggest causes of epigenetic change because it knocks your body out of balance. It comes in three forms: physical stress, trauma, chemical stress, toxins, and emotional stress, fear, worry, being overwhelmed, and so on. Each type can set off more than 1,400 chemical reactions and produce more than 30 hormones and neurotransmitters. When the chemical cascade of stress hormones is triggered, your mind influences your body through the autonomic nervous system, and you experience the ultimate mind-body connection. Ironically, feeling stressed was designed to be adaptive. All organisms in nature, including humans, are programmed to deal with short-term stress so that they'll have the resources they need for emergency situations. When you sense a threat in your external environment, the fight-or-flight response in your sympathetic nervous system, a subsystem of your autonomic nervous system, is activated, and your heart rate and blood pressure increase, your muscles tense, and hormones like adrenaline and cortisol shoot through your body to prepare you to either flee or face your foe in battle. If you're being chased by a pack of wild, hungry wolves or a party of violent warriors and you outrun them, your body will return to homeostasis, its normal balanced state, soon after you reach safety. That's the way our bodies were designed to operate when we're living in survival mode. The body is out of balance, but only for a short period of time until the danger passes. At least, that's how it was meant to be. The same thing happens in our modern world, although the setting is usually a little different. If someone cuts you off when you're driving on the highway, you might be momentarily frightened, but once you realize that you're okay, and you let go of the fear of having an accident, your body returns to normal. Unless that was only one of countless stressful situations you stumbled into that day. If you're like most people, a string of nerve-wracking incidents keeps you in fight-or-flight response and out of homeostasis a large part of the time. Maybe the car cutting you off is the only actual life-threatening situation you encounter all day. But the traffic on the way to work, the pressure of preparing for a big presentation, the argument you had with your spouse, the credit card bill that came in the mail, the crashing of your computer hard drive, and the new gray hair you noticed in the mirror keep the stress hormones circulating in your body on a near-constant basis. Between remembering stressful experiences from the past and anticipating stressful situations coming up in your future, all these repetitive, short-term stresses blur together into long-term stress. Welcome to the 21st century version of living in survival mode. In fight-or-flight mode, life-sustaining energy is mobilized so that the body can either run or fight. But when there isn't a return to homeostasis, because you keep perceiving a threat, vital energy is lost in the system. You have less energy in your internal environment for cell growth and repair, long-term building projects on a cellular level, and healing when that energy is being channeled elsewhere. The cells shut down, they no longer communicate with one another, and they become selfish. It's not time for routine maintenance, let alone for making improvements. It's time for defense. It's every cell for itself, so the collective community of cells working together becomes fractured. The immune and endocrine systems, among others, become weakened as genes in those related cells are compromised when informational signals from outside the cells are turned off. It's like living in a country where 98% of the resources go toward defense and nothing is left for schools, libraries, road building and repair, communication systems, growing of food and so on. Roads develop potholes that aren't fixed. Schools suffer budget cuts, so students wind up learning less. Social welfare programs that took care of the poor and the elderly have to close down. And there's not enough food to feed the masses. Not surprisingly then, long-term stress has been linked to anxiety, depression, digestive problems, memory loss, insomnia, hypertension, heart disease, strokes, cancer, ulcers, rheumatoid arthritis, colds, flu, aging acceleration, allergies, body pain, chronic fatigue, infertility, impotence, asthma, hormonal issues, skin rashes, hair loss, muscle spasms and diabetes, to name just a few conditions, all of which, by the way, are the result of epigenetic changes. No organism in nature is designed to withstand the effects of long-term stress. Several studies give strong evidence to show how epigenetic instructions for healing shut down during emergencies. For example, researchers at the Ohio State University Medical Center found that more than 170 genes were affected by stress, with 100 of them shutting off completely, including many that directly make proteins to facilitate the proper type of wound healing. The researchers reported that wounds of stress patients took 40% longer to heal, and that stress tilted the genomic balance towards genes that were encoding proteins responsible for cell cycle arrest, death, and inflammation. Another study examined the genes of 100 citizens of Detroit, zeroed in on 23 subjects who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. These people had 6 to 7 times more epigenetic variations, most of which involved compromising the immune system. Researchers at the UCLA AIDS Institute found that not only did HIV spread faster in patients who were the most stressed, but also the higher a patient's stress level, the less he or she responded to the antiretroviral drugs. The drugs worked 4 times better for those patients who were relatively calm, compared to those whose blood pressure, skin moisture, and resting heart rate indicated that they were feeling the most stress. Based on these findings, researchers concluded that the nervous system has a direct effect on viral replication. Although the fight-or-flight response was originally highly adaptive, because it kept early humans alive, it's now clear that the longer that survival system is constantly activated, the longer your body shunts its resources for creating optimal health, so the system becomes maladaptive. As we keep making stress hormones, we create a host of highly addictive negative emotions, including anger, hostility, aggression, competition, hatred, frustration, fear, anxiety, jealousy, insecurity, guilt, shame, sadness, depression, hopelessness, and powerlessness, just to name a few. When we focus on thoughts about bitter past memories or imagine dreadful futures to the exclusion of everything else, we prevent the body from regaining homeostasis. In truth, we're capable of turning on the stress response by thought alone. If we turn it on and then can't turn it off, we're surely headed for some type of illness or disease, be it a cold or cancer. As more and more genes get downregulated in a domino effect until we eventually arrive at our genetic destiny. For example, if we can anticipate a possible known future scenario and then focus on that thought to the exclusion of everything else, even for just one moment, the body will physiologically begin to change in order to prepare itself for that future event. The body is now living in that known future in the present moment. As a consequence of this phenomenon, the conditioning process begins to activate the autonomic nervous system, and it creates the corresponding stress chemicals automatically. This is how the mind-body connection can work against us. When this happens, we are demonstrating the 3 elements of the placebo effect in perfect symmetry. First, we start to condition the body to the rush of adrenal chemistry in order to feel a boost of energy. If we can associate a person, thing, or experience at a particular time and place in our outer reality with that rush of chemistry within us, we'll begin to condition the body to turn on the response just by thinking about that stimulus. In time, we'll be able to simply condition the body to be put in mind of that emotionally aroused state by thought alone. The thought of a potential experience with someone and something at some time and some place. If we can expect the future outcome based on the past experience, then the expectation of the event, when we emotionally embrace it, will change the body's physiology. And if we assign meaning to the behaviors and experiences, we're putting our conscious intention behind the outcome, so that our bodies will change or not change equal to what we think we know about our reality and ourselves. But whether or not you believe that the stress in your life is justified or valid, the effect of that stress on the body is never advantageous or health-enhancing. Your body believes that it is being chased by a lion, is standing perched on a perilous cliff, or is fighting off a pack of angry cannibals. Here are a few examples from scientific studies demonstrating the effects of stress on the body. Researchers at the Ohio State University College of Medicine confirmed that stressful emotions trigger hormonal and genetic responses by measuring how stress affects the speed of healing minor skin wounds, a significant marker of gene activation. A group of 42 married couples were given small suction blisters and then their level of three proteins commonly expressed in wound healing was monitored for a total of 3 weeks. The couples were asked to have a neutral discussion for half an hour as a baseline, and then, later, to talk about a previous marital argument. The researchers found that after the couples discussed a previous disagreement, their level of healing-linked proteins was mildly suppressed, showing that the genes were downregulated. The suppression rose to an even greater degree, about 40%, in couples whose discussion ballooned into a significant conflict, peppered with sarcastic comments, criticism, and put-downs. Research also supports the reverse effect, that reducing stress with positive emotions triggers epigenetic changes that improve health. Two key studies by researchers at the Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine, Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, looked at the effects of meditation, which is known for eliciting peaceful and even blissful states, on gene expression. In the first study, conducted in 2008, 20 volunteers received 8 weeks of training in various mind-body practices, including several types of meditation, yoga, and repetitive prayer, known to induce the relaxation response, a physiological state of deep rest, discussed in Chapter 2. The researchers also followed 19 long-term daily practitioners of the same techniques. At the end of the study period, the novices showed a change in 1,561 genes, 874 upregulated for health, and 687 downregulated for stress, as well as reduced blood pressure and reduced heart and respiration rates, while the experienced practitioners expressed 2,209 new genes. Most of the genetic changes involved improving the body's response to chronic psychological stress. The second study, conducted in 2013, found that eliciting the relaxation response produces changes in gene expression after just one session of meditation, among both novices and experienced practitioners alike, with the long-term practitioners, not surprisingly, deriving more benefit. Genes that were upregulated included those involved in the immune function, energy metabolism, and insulin secretion, while genes that were downregulated included those linked to inflammation and stress. Studies like these underscore just how quickly it's possible to change your own genes. That's why the placebo response can produce physical changes in a matter of moments. In my workshops around the world, my colleagues and I have witnessed significant and immediate changes in our participants' health after only one session of meditation. They transformed themselves and activated new genes in new ways by thought alone. You'll be introduced to some of them soon. When we're living in survival mode, with our stress response turned on all the time, we can really focus on only three things: our physical bodies, am I okay, the environment, where is it safe, and time, how long will this threat be hanging over me? Constantly focusing on these three things makes us less spiritual, less aware, and less mindful, because it trains us to become more self-absorbed and more focused on our bodies, as well as on other material things, such as what we own, where we live, how much money we have, and so on, in addition to all of the problems we experience in our external world. This focus also trains us to obsess about time, to constantly brace ourselves for the worst-case future scenarios, based on our traumatic past experiences. Because there's never enough time, and everything always takes too much time. So we could say that just as stress hormones cause the cells of the body to become selfish to ensure that we survive, they endorse our ego to become more selfish too, and we become materialists, defining reality with our senses. We end up feeling separate from any new possibilities, Because when we never leave that state of chronic emergency, that me-first mentality that pervades all our thinking strengthens and endures, leading us to become self-indulgent, self-serving, and self-important. Ultimately, the self becomes defined as a body living in the environment and in time. As you have just read and now more fully understand, the reality is that you do indeed have some degree of control over your own genetic engineering, by way of your thoughts, choices, behaviors, experiences, and emotions. Like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, who had the power she sought all along but didn't know it, you also possess a power that you may not have previously realized was yours. The keys that can set you free of being chained to the limitations of your own genetic expression. Chapter 5. How Thoughts Change the Brain and the Body. Now you can understand that whether it's joyful or stressful, with every thought you think, every emotion you feel, and every event you experience, you're acting as an epigenetic engineer of your own cells. You control your destiny. So this raises another question. If your environment changes, and you then program new genes in new ways, is it possible, based on your perceptions and beliefs, to program the gene ahead of the actual environment? Feelings and emotions are normally the end products of experiences. But you can combine a clear intention with an emotion that begins to give the body a sampling of the future experience before it's been made manifest. When you're truly focused on an intention for some future outcome, if you can make inner thought more real than the outer environment during the process, the brain won't know the difference between the two. Then your body, as the unconscious mind, will begin to experience the new future event in the present moment. You'll signal new genes in new ways to prepare for this imagined future event. If you continue to mentally practice enough times this new series of choices, behaviors, and experiences that you desire, reproducing the same new level of mind over and over again, then your brain will begin to physically change, installing new neurological circuitry to begin to think from that new level of mind, to look as if the experience has already happened. You'll be producing epigenetic variations that lead to real structural and functional changes in the body by thought alone, just as do those who respond to a placebo. Then your brain and body will no longer be living in the same past. They'll be living in the new future that you created in your mind. This is possible through mental rehearsal. This technique is basically closing your eyes and repeatedly imagining performing an action, and mentally reviewing the future you want, all the while reminding yourself of who you no longer want to be, the old self, and who you do want to be. This process involves thinking about your future actions, mentally planning your choices, and focusing your mind on a new experience. Let's go over this sequence in greater detail so we can more thoroughly understand exactly what's happening in mental rehearsal and how it works. As you mentally rehearse a destiny or dream about a new outcome, you imagine it over and over again until it becomes familiar to you. The more knowledge and experience you have wired in your brain about the new reality you desire, the more resources you have to create a better model of it in your mental picturing, and so the greater your intention and expectation are. As with the hotel maids, you are reminding yourself of what your life will look like and feel like once you get what you want. Now you are putting an intention behind your attention. Then you consciously marry your thoughts and intentions with a heightened state of emotion, such as joy or gratitude. More on heightened states of emotion is coming up. Once you can embrace that new emotion and you get more excited, You're bathing your body in the neurochemistry that would be present if that future event were actually happening. It could be suggested that you're giving your body a taste of the future experience. Your brain and body don't know the difference between having an actual experience in your life and just thinking about the experience. Neurochemically, it's the same. So your brain and body begin to believe they're actually living in the new experience in the present moment. By keeping your focus on this future event and not letting any other thoughts distract you, in a matter of moments, you turn down the volume on the neural circuits connected to the old self, which begins to turn off the old genes, and you fire and wire new neural circuits, which initiates the right signals to activate new genes in new ways. Thanks to the neuroplasticity discussed previously, the circuits in your brain begin to reorganize themselves to reflect what you're mentally rehearsing. And as you keep coupling your new thoughts and mental images with that strong, positive emotion, then your mind and body are working together, and you're now in a new state of being. At this point, your brain and body are no longer a record of the past. They are a map to the future, a future that you have created in your mind. Your thoughts have become your experience, and you just became the placebo. Maybe you heard that story a while back about a major who was imprisoned in a concentration camp in Vietnam, who mentally practiced playing golf on a particular course every day to keep himself sane, only to shoot a perfect score when he was finally released and returned home. Or perhaps you've heard the account of Soviet human rights activist Anatoly Sharansky, later known as Nardin Sharansky, who spent more than 9 years imprisoned in the Soviet Union after being falsely accused of spying for the United States in the 1970s. Sharansky, who spent 400 days of his prison term in a small, darkened, freezing cold punishment cell, played a game of mental chess against himself every day, keeping track of the board coordinates and the positions of each piece in his mind. This enabled Sharansky to maintain many of his neural maps, which normally require external stimulation to stay intact. After his release, he immigrated to Israel and eventually became an Israeli cabinet minister. When world chess champion Garry Kasparov came to Israel in 1996 to play a simultaneous chess match against 25 Israelis, Sharansky beat him. Aaron Rodgers, quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, also imagines moves in his head that he often later executes with precision on the field. Leading up to the Packers' 2011 Super Bowl win, in a playoff game that the sixth-seeded Packers won 48-21 against the top-seeded Atlanta Falcons, Rodgers completed 31 of the 36 passes, 86.1%, the fifth best postseason completion percentage of all time. In the sixth grade, a coach taught us about the importance of visualization, Rodgers told a sports reporter for USA Today. When I'm in a meeting, watching film, or lying in bed before I go to sleep, I always visualize making those plays. A lot of those plays I made in the game, I had thought about. As I lay on the couch, I visualize making them. Rodgers was also able to successfully spin out of three potential sacks in that game. Later noting about those plays, I visualized the majority before I made them. Countless other professional athletes have also used mental rehearsal to stunning effect, including golfer Tiger Woods, basketball stars Michael Jordan, Larry Bird and Jerry West, and baseball pitcher Roy Halladay. Champion golfer Jack Nicklaus wrote in his book, Golf My Way, "I never hit a shot, even in practice, without having a very sharp, in-focus picture of it in my head. It's like a color movie. First I see the ball where I want it to finish, nice and white and sitting up high on the bright green grass. Then the scene quickly changes, and I see the ball going there, its path, trajectory, and shape, even its behavior on landing. Then there's sort of a fade-out, and the next scene shows me making the kind of swing that will turn the previous images into reality. Only at the end of this short, private Hollywood spectacular do I select a club and step up to the ball. As we can see from these examples alone, and there are many, many more just like them, plenty of evidence shows that mental rehearsal is extremely effective for learning a physical skill with minimal physical practice. I can't resist adding one more example, this time from Jim Carrey, who tells an amazing story about what he did when he first came to Los Angeles in the late 1980s as a struggling actor looking for work. He'd written a paragraph-long affirmation on a piece of paper about meeting the right type of people, getting the right type of acting jobs, working on the right movie with the right casting, and being successful and contributing something worthwhile and making a difference in the world. He would go up to Mulholland Drive in the Hollywood Hills every night. He'd lean back in his convertible and look up at the sky. He'd say that paragraph to himself, committing it to memory, as he imagined that what he was describing was actually happening. And he wouldn't drive back down from that Hollywood overlook until he felt as though he was the person he'd been imagining, until it felt real for him. He even wrote a check to himself for $10 million, penning "For acting services rendered" on it, and dating it Thanksgiving 1995. He carried the check in his wallet for years. Finally, in 1994, three movies were released that made Carrey a star. First, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, came out in February, followed by The Mask in July. And for his role in the third movie, Dumb and Dumber, released in December, Carrey received a check for exactly $10 million. He created exactly what he had envisioned for himself. What all these individuals have in common is that they eliminated the external environment, got beyond their bodies and transcended time so that they could make significant neurological changes within. When they presented themselves to the world, they were able to get their minds and bodies to work together, and they created in the material world what they'd first conceived in the mental realm. Scientific studies back this up. To start with, many experiments on mental rehearsal prove that when you concentrate on a particular region of the body, your thoughts stimulate the region in the brain that governs that part. And if you keep doing it, physical changes in the brain's sensory area will then follow. It makes sense, because if you keep placing your awareness in the same place, you are firing and wiring the same networks of neurons. And as a result, you'll build stronger brain maps in that area. In a Harvard study, research subjects who'd never before played the piano mentally practiced a simple five-finger piano exercise for 2 hours a day for 5 days and made the same brain changes as the subjects who physically practiced the same activities but without ever lifting a finger. The region of their brains that controls finger movements increased dramatically, allowing their brains to look as though the experience they'd imagined had actually happened. They installed the neurological hardware, circuits, and software, programs, thereby creating new brain maps by thought alone. In another study of 30 people over a 12-week period, some regularly exercised their little fingers, while others just imagined doing the same thing. While the group that actually did the physical exercises increased the strength of their little fingers by 53%, the group that only imagined doing the same thing also increased the strength of their little fingers by 35%. Their bodies had changed to look as if they were having the physical experience in external reality over and over again. But they only experienced it in their minds. Their minds changed their bodies. In a similar experiment, 10 volunteers each imagined flexing one of their biceps as hard as they could 5 times a week. Researchers recorded the subjects' electrical brain activity during the sessions and measured their muscle strength every 2 weeks. Those who only imagined flexing increased their bicep muscle strength by 13.5% in just a few weeks, and they maintained the gain for 3 months after the training stopped. Their bodies responded to a new mind. A final example is a French study that compared subjects who either lifted or imagined lifting dumbbells of different weights. Those who imagined lifting heavier weights activated their muscles more than did those who imagined lifting lighter weights. In all three of these studies on mental rehearsal, the subjects were able to measurably increase their body strength using only their thoughts. You may well wonder if studies exist showing what happens when we follow the entire sequence. When we not only imagine what we want to create, but also connect with strong positive emotion. As a matter of fact, they do, and you'll be reading about them soon enough. To understand more fully why mental rehearsal works, we need to look at just a few points of brain anatomy for a moment, and then briefly add some neurochemistry. Let's start by explaining that your frontal lobe, located right behind your forehead, is your creative center. This is the part of the brain that learns new things, dreams of new possibilities, makes conscious decisions, sets your intentions, and so on. It's the CEO, so to speak, and even more to the point, the frontal lobe also allows you to observe who you are and evaluate what you're doing and how you're feeling. It's the home of your conscience. This is important because once you become more aware of your thoughts, ultimately, you can better direct them. As you practice mental rehearsal and truly concentrate and focus on the outcome you want, the frontal lobe is your ally because it also lowers the volume on the outside world so that you're not as distracted by information coming in from your 5 senses. Brain scans show that in a highly focused state, such as mental rehearsal, the perception of time and space diminishes. This happens because your frontal lobe dials down the input from your sensory centers, which allow you to feel your body in space, your motor centers, responsible for your physical movement, and your association centers, where your thoughts about your identity and who you are live, as well as your parietal lobe circuits, where you process time. Because you can get beyond your environment, beyond your body, and even beyond time, you're better able to make the thought you're thinking more real than anything else. The moment you imagine a new future for yourself, think about a new possibility and start to ask specific questions, as what would it be like to live without this pain and limitation, your frontal lobe snaps to attention. In a matter of seconds, it creates both an intention to be healthy, so you get clear on what you want to create and what you no longer wish to experience, and a mental picture of being healthy, so that you can imagine what it will be like. As the CEO, the frontal lobe has connections to all the other parts of the brain. So it starts selecting networks of neurons to create a new state of mind as an answer to that question. You might say it becomes a symphony conductor, silencing your old hard wiring, the pruning function of neuroplasticity, and selecting different networks of neurons from different parts of the brain and wiring them together to create a new level of mind to reflect what you were imagining. It's your frontal lobe that changes your mind. That is, it makes the brain work in different sequences, patterns, and combinations. Once the frontal lobe can select different networks of neurons and seamlessly turn them on in tandem to create a new level of mind, a picture or internal representation appears in your mind's eye or frontal lobe. Now let's bring in some more neurochemistry. If your frontal lobe is orchestrating enough of these neural nets to fire in unison as you focus on a clear intention, there will come a moment when the thought will become the experience in your mind. That's when your inner reality is more real than your outer reality. Once the thought becomes the experience, you begin to feel the emotion of how the event would feel in reality. Remember, emotions are the chemical signatures of experiences. Your brain makes a different type of chemical messenger, a neuropeptide, and it sends it out to the cells in your body. The neuropeptide looks for the appropriate receptor sites or docking stations on various cells so that it can deliver its message to the body's hormonal centers and, ultimately, the cell's DNA. And the cells get a new message that the event has occurred. When the DNA in a cell gets this new information from the neuropeptide, it responds by turning on or upregulating some genes and turning off or downregulating others, all to support your new state of being. Think of the upregulating and downregulating as lights either heating up or getting brighter or cooling off and getting dimmer. When a gene lights up, it's activated to make a protein. When a gene turns off, it becomes deactivated and gets dimmer or weaker. And it doesn't produce as many proteins. And we see the effects with measurable changes in our physical bodies. Take a look at figure 5.1a and figure 5.1b. They will help you follow the entire sequence of how to change your body by thought alone. Stem cells are the next layer we need to understand in the puzzle. They're at least partially responsible for how the seemingly impossible becomes possible. Officially, these are undifferentiated biological cells that become specialized. They're raw potential. When these blank slates are activated, they morph into whatever kind of cell the body needs, including muscle cells, bone cells, skin cells, immune cells, and even nerve cells in the brain, in order to replace injured or damaged cells in the body's tissues, organs, and systems. Think of stem cells as scoops of shaved snow cone ice before the flavored syrup is pumped on top, lumps of clay waiting on the potter's wheel for their turn to be fashioned into plates, bowls, vases, or mugs, or maybe even a roll of silver duct tape that can fix a leaking pipe one day and be cleverly fashioned into a prom dress the next. Here's an example of how stem cells work. When you cut your finger, the body needs to repair the break in the skin. The local physical trauma sends a signal to your genes from outside the cell. The gene turns on and makes the appropriate proteins, which then instructs stem cells to turn into healthy, functioning skin cells. The traumatic signal is the information the stem cell needs to differentiate into a skin cell. Millions of processes like this occur all over our bodies all the time. Healing attributable to this type of gene expression has been documented in the liver, muscles, skin, intestines, bone marrow, and even the brain and the heart. In wound healing studies, where the subject is in a highly emotional, negative state like anger, the stem cells don't get the message clearly. When there's interference in the signal, as with static on the radio, the potential cell doesn't get the right stimulation in a coherent fashion to turn itself into a useful cell. As you know from reading the section about the stress response and living in survival mode, the healing will take longer because most of the body's energy is busy dealing with the angry emotion and its chemical effects. It's just not the time for creation, growth, and nurturing. It's the time for an emergency. So when the placebo effect is at work, and you create the right level of mind with clear intention, and combine it with a nurturing, elevated emotion, the right type of signal can reach the cell's DNA. The message will not only influence the production of healthy proteins for better structure and function of the body, but also make brand new, healthy cells from latent stem cells that are just waiting to be activated by the right message. You could even think of these stem cells as get-out-of-jail-free cards, as in the game Monopoly, because once they're picked up or activated, they replace cells in damaged areas of the body, allowing for a fresh, clean